Okay, we have a quorum, so we can get started. Hopefully everybody dressed warmly or has some warm clothes, because we are gonna plan on going out this afternoon. And I'll give you a detailed handout when we meet, but I would like to ask that everybody be here at 1:30 promptly, because the sooner we get going, then the sooner we get back. And I'm expecting that we'll be back somewhere between 4:30 and 5 o'clock, depending on how things go. You don't really need to bring anything special along with you, other than if you've got something to write with, that would be good. And those field guides that you had worked on before, if you've got those, you might find that helpful as well. So what we'll do is just meet here down in the lab, down the hall, and we won't need a whole lot of equipment, but we've got a couple vans lined up that we can all crowd into, okay? And you guys have a van that you'll come over with? Okay, we're not gonna be going off-road today, so it doesn't really matter what you're driving. Let's see, a couple other things. How many people are planning on getting started on their project over spring break? Okay, 1, 2, 3. Well, I think what we ought to do is maybe right after class, I could, if you guys have time, I could maybe give you a little bit of guidance on what you might need to, some considerations that you should have if you're gonna be doing, because we really haven't been out in the field, and I know that puts everybody at a bit of a disadvantage. And sometimes at this time of the year, as we've seen, the weather isn't that nice. And if you end up having to go out on a less than ideal day to do the work, you can kind of minimize the time that you spend outside. And I'll give you a couple guidelines about that. Okay, on Tuesday, we were talking about diagnostic horizons and features. And I think we pretty much got through the list. There were some special, the category number 3, other diagnostic features. We started going down through those, and I'd like to just finish that up real quickly. The first one on the list was ANDIC properties, and we said this is, it's a actually a suite of properties that we'll talk more about when we get to the ANDIC soils or the andisols. But just for right now, you know, it's the properties associated with the volcanic ash mantles that we might see around here in some of our forested soils. Aqua conditions, these are wet soils or waterlogged soils, and we've talked about BG horizons, and that's really what we're talking about, is a soil that's going to have these glade or low chroma colors, the dull grays, and the lack of the higher chroma colors. So aqua conditions, it really is just a code for waterlogged or wet soils. High coefficient of linear extensibility, that's the shrink swell. Slick insides were on the list, and that we saw some of those in lab, these shiny faces in clayey soils that shrink and swell according to moisture content. And those are also diagnostic features. Paralithic contact, this would be an example here. Paralithic contact generally is going to be a horizon you designate with the C with the small r, meaning that it's diggable, so it has weathered to some degree. And then a lithic contact would simply be hard bedrock, or what we would designate as an R material. And these will turn up in the classification at some levels. Permafrost, thermal condition, and this is a diagnostic feature for gelisols. And the, well, we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to gelisols. Plinthite. The plinthite, I think whoever gave the definition, I don't remember who it was, but they mentioned iron-rich, humus-poor material in the subsoil. And one of the characteristics of plinthite is that once it, remember this was the BV horizon that we talked about, And we said that it can harden irreversibly. And these are plinthite blocks that have been excavated out of the soil. They're allowed to be subjected to wet and dry cycles, and then they become actually building material, and very good building material. So those are the most of the diagnostic horizons and features that we're going to consider. And as you're going to see, these things turn up in the classification system, as we said before, at the higher levels. Like in some cases, it defines a soil order, the presence of one of these things, and sometimes it comes out at the suborder level or grade group level or subgroup level. And so, but you'll recognize a lot of these as we start going through the different soil orders. Now, if you think back to last week, said that the classification of soils in soil taxonomy was based on the presence or absence of these diagnostic horizons. And what else? Remember? Yeah, soil moisture and temperature regimes. And so that's what we're going to spend today talking about, are these soil moisture and temperature regimes. And we've already talked about the role that soil moisture has in terms of the plant communities and water driving a lot of these soil forming processes. Temperature, also important for biological processes, as well as chemical weathering. So it's really from a scientific standpoint and a land use standpoint, these are both pretty important characteristics. And in soil taxonomy, they are really emphasized. And we're going to see how that works. So there's a handout up here that I gave you. And this is it's just a collection of some figures that what we're going to talk about, because these are related to soil moisture regimes primarily. And when we talked about climate as a soil forming factor, one of the things that we said, it's not just the total amount of precipitation that you get. It's also related to the seasonality or the distribution over the course of a season. And what soil taxonomy has done is recognize six different soil moisture regimes. And these are based to some degree on the amount of precipitation, but much more importantly on the distribution of it. And I'd like to run through a couple of examples of these things. And let's start at the wet end. We have what's known as an aquic, and then SMR is just soil moisture regime. Well, the name aquic suggests what?
Water.
Yeah, that it's wet. And this would be a soil that we would call a waterlogged soil, or one that has, we just got done talking about this, aquic conditions, which is a combination of the soil being saturated at or near the surface for a significant period of time during the year, the rhodoxomorphic features like the clay soil colors or modeling patterns, and these would be soils that in general are too wet for most types of land use unless they're drained. You know, they're fine for wetlands and those types of environments, but at least for what we commonly think of as land uses, agriculture, building, things like that, far too wet. And so you're going to see that these soil moisture regimes have a practical interpretation associated with them. So these guys are wet. If we look at some of the others, and we're kind of going to go from wet to dry, the next one on the list is a periudic soil moisture regime. Periudic, P-E-R-U-D-I-C. And this is a situation where for every month out of the year, the precipitation is greater than PET, or potential evapotranspiration. Now, just to make sure we're all on the same page with this, what is potential evapotranspiration?
Water loss?
Yeah, it's essentially water loss. It's the total amount of water that will be evaporated from soil surface and plant surfaces and also transpired by growing plants as they photosynthesize. So just think of it as really it's water demand, I guess, or water loss. And in this type of an environment where you have a periodic soil moisture regime, the precip every month is going to be greater than the water demand. So you don't have a situation where there's any kind of moisture stress, or if you do, it's going to be very, very short term. Okay? Can you think of any place around where we would have periodic soil moisture regimes? Well, it could be. Remember, tropical does not imply anything about moisture. It's all about temperature, and we'll get to that in a minute. But Seattle is not quite periodic. No, possibly if you got over on the Olympic Peninsula and places, you might get something close. I think a lot of there are areas where you get a lot of fog in the summertime, and those might qualify as periodic. I know they have them up in Alaska. I'm not sure you'd find a lot of them in the lower 48. There probably would be some in the coastal areas. And then if we dry up a little bit, we get into, and this is an important one, eutic moisture regime. And I guess the root here that I would think of is humid. Eutic, humid. And the idea here is that this is a soil moisture regime that is defined by having a very limited period of time where there is a soil moisture deficit. And I'll show you the examples here. When we look at these water balances. But the practical idea here is that in a eutic soil moisture regime, you get rainfall or precipitation that is fairly well distributed throughout the year, and there's enough during the growing season coupled with the water storage capacity of the soil that the plants are not going to exhibit much water stress. And in fact, if you read the fine print, it comes down to the fact that there's not going to be as many as 90 cumulative days during the growing season when that soil is dry, where there's no plant available water. So it's a very limited soil moisture deficit. And let me just go through the rest of these, and then we can talk about the diagrams. The next one is ustic. And I guess the word I would think about for that is dust, since it kind of sounds the same. An ustic soil moisture regime is one in which you have a much longer period of soil moisture deficit. And if you read in soil taxonomy, that we said for the eutic moisture regime, there's less than 90 days when the soil's dry. Well, this one would be more than 90 days when the soil is dry, okay? So you're starting to get a longer period of soil moisture deficit. And just to give you an idea where you find these, a eutic soil moisture regime would be most of the eastern United States, at least the well-drained environments. The ustic soil moisture regime is as you start to move west, you get out close to the 100th meridian, where we kind of think of the semi-arid, humid boundary, and a lot of the Great Plains states would have an ustic soil moisture regime. And we get even drier, we get into this next one, which is called aridic. And I'm going to put this other word in parentheses, toric, T-O-R-R-I-C, because these are the same thing. It's just in some cases in soil taxonomy, we use the term aridic, other times toric, and I wouldn't worry about it right now, but as the name suggests, this is a pretty dry type of situation, and it would be if you read the fine print, the soil is going to be dry for most of the year. And the idea here is that this is an environment that is too dry for any kind of agricultural production. You might get some range use, but without irrigation, you're really not going to have too many options as far as plant growth. Ustic, on the other hand, this would be the type of environment where it's probably good for grain production, you know, dry land grain production, because you get enough moisture during at least the early part of the growing season for plants, but then it tends to dry up. So there's five of them. The last one, put down here, this happens to be what we have in a lot of the Northwest, and that is what's known as a xeric soil moisture regime. And this is often characterized as being a Mediterranean type climate. And what that generally refers to is a temperate region, not tropical. You don't find xeric regimes in the tropics. This is a temperate regions only. And the moisture regime is characterized by having cool, moist winters. And warm or hot, dry summers. Sounds a lot like around here, and that's exactly what it is. The idea here in a xeric regime is that a lot of the moisture is coming during the period of time when plants aren't doing much. So it's really the non-growing season precip. Now that handout that I gave you, I think I need to go over that because this may illustrate these things a little bit better. And this first image is a map of the United States showing the different moisture regimes. And the first thing that you might be struck by when you look at this is how simple it is in the eastern United States. Everything is either blue or green. The blue refers, I don't know if you can read it, but that's the aquic soil moisture regime, and you can see how it's all of the coastal areas and looks like a whole bunch of Florida. But Gulf Coast, Atlantic Coast, Mississippi River Valley, and then isolated areas. But these are large areas where you have wet soils. You get out in the western United States, you don't see too much of it. It's not that we don't have soils with aquic moisture regimes, but they tend to be much more limited in extent to smaller areas. And they're not going to show up on a map at this scale. This is a 1 to 9 million scale map. But the green here is the eutic moisture regime, or what I'm calling the humid moisture regime. And you can see it's pretty much most of the area that's going to be east of the 100th meridian, or what we think of as the humid part of the United States. Okay, now as we start to move west, here's where it gets dry. All of these brown colors that you see in these vertical bands here in the Great Plains, these would represent ustic moisture regimes. And you can see that from Texas up through Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska into the Dakotas, eastern Montana, all of this is ustic. And I'll show you the moisture balance for it. When you get out beyond that, further west, it really turns into a mess. And it's pretty hard to delineate the different moisture regimes. They've got several different categories because we recognize that there are areas where it's kind of borderline between being, say, aridic and ustic and those types of things, and that's what some of these colors represent. But the yellow color that you see in the western United States and primarily down in the southwest, that would be aridic moisture regime. So those are the really dry soils. The orange that you see up here and in California, Washington, Oregon, northern Idaho, parts of southern Idaho, that is the xeric soil moisture regime. And then this red is kind of a hybrid between xeric and aridic, kind of right on the border. But you can see how topography really plays an important role in these moisture regimes in the western United States because of the orographic effects of mountains. And generally, if you're at the lower elevations, it's drier. And as you go up in elevation, of course, you tend to get more precip and you get a change in the moisture regime. So I guess the point here is that it's pretty straightforward in the plains and the eastern United States. When you get into the west, it's much more complicated, or at least in terms of the spatial distribution. But the desert southwest, a lot of this is aridic, and then the northwest and a lot of California we think of as xeric. Are there any questions about this? Just the overall distribution? Okay, well, let's look at some of these in a little bit more detail. And this is these should be on the handout that I gave you. This first one is an example of the water balance for a eutic soil moisture regime, and I think I showed you this one before. The way you look at this, these dots here represent the potential evapotranspiration. The dashed line there is the precip. And maybe even more importantly is these letters that you see. And these letters correspond to really the status of soil moisture. So if you look here at the, let's start here in the fall, okay? So you've got rainfall that starts to really exceed the water demand, okay? So the rainfall is a lot greater than the potential evapotranspiration. Notice the label in there, R. That stands for recharge. So that means that there's more water being added to the system than plants are using, so we're recharging soil moisture. Now, soils are only going to hold so much, and you notice right here, looks like it's somewhere in December or January, instead of an R, we go to an S, and that S is over here on the other side too. The S stands for surplus, and what that means is that the soil has stored all of the water that it can, and even though the precip continues to exceed that the potential evapotranspiration, there's really no place for that water to go. So it either moves down through the soil as deep percolation, where it might be recharging aquifers and groundwater, or it runs off and causes erosion. So it's this idea of a soil water surplus. But when you think about leaching in a soil, certainly a lot of it is going to occur during this time of the year when you have surplus water or lots of water available to move down through the soil. Well, then once we get into the growing season, the potential evapotranspiration really shoots up. It's kind of a function of temperature, among some other things, day length, and there's some other variables that go in it. But, so here's the PET. It's greater than the precip, but for a period of several months, there's enough stored soil moisture that the plants are able, they're going to be happy. They're able to extract water, so they're doing okay. And then this period in here that's labeled with a D stands for deficit, and that's the soil water deficit. And you can see that it's a very short period of time in a eutic moisture regime, and that's kind of the key. Yeah, Hannah?
Could you also call it the drought would necessarily be, or is that...
The D?
D.
Well, it's I don't know if I'd call it drought, but it's when the soil, you think of it as dry, okay? The soil is dry at that point, but the plants are really only having to endure a very short period of time where they don't have moisture. So that's kind of the idea of this eutic soil moisture regime, very limited amount of deficit period during the growing season. Now if you compare that with, here's another one, this is Oklahoma City. This is out in the Great Plains, so we're looking at an ustic soil moisture regime. And you can see this looks a lot different. Here's the precip. Notice that most of it comes during the early part of the growing season, which is pretty good for the plants, and then it kind of tapers off during the non-growing season or the winter months. Here's the potential evapotranspiration really shooting up in the summertime. Well, if we start down here in October, let's start down here in December. We're finally getting the precip exceeding the potential evapotranspiration. So here's where we start to recharge the soil, and that continues into February. So it's a really short period of time of recharge. And then we have this starting probably about February or so, March, we have this period of utilization, meaning that here's where the plants are really starting to take off and they're utilizing the stored soil moisture, okay? So they're pretty happy until they've used all of the stored soil moisture, and then we go into this pretty long period of a soil moisture deficit, and there's the D again. And you can see in this case, it extends for several months. So obviously you're going to have different types of plants, and generally if you think about native vegetation and ustic moisture regimes, it's often a grassland type environment where the grasses do most of their growing in the early part of the growing season, and then they senesce and sort of take the rest of the growing season off because there's really not much moisture. And there are trees that are adapted to these types of moisture regimes as well. But compared to the eutic regime, a much longer period of a soil moisture deficit. Okay, and this next one is an aridic or toric regime. This is from Phoenix, Arizona. If you've ever been to Phoenix, you know how hot and dry it is. And take a look at the water balance. Here's the period of utilization, very, very short, just because there's not much precip, and you really don't get a lot of stored soil moisture in that type of environment. It starts to heat up, and look at the period of soil moisture deficit. It's by far most of the growing season and much of the year, right? And that's what characterizes these aridic moisture regimes. It's just a really long period of soil moisture deficit. And that's why if you look at the native vegetation around Phoenix, it's really specialized plants. It's plants that are able to probably extract water that other plants aren't able to, and they're also able to tolerate long periods of dry. And you also see why there's not going to be a whole lot of leaching going on in a soil in an aridic environment, right? Because there's just not much, there's no surplus water, and very limited period of time when there's actually water moving into the soil. Okay, and last but not least, here's the xeric moisture regime. This figure is a little bit different, but I did try and label it for you. This is for Portland, and two things to point out. These triangles represent the precipitation. Notice how it's really high here in January, February. You get into June, July, August, very, very low, and then it comes back up in the wintertime. So you look at the distribution of precip, and it's exactly opposite of the growing season, which for a lot of plants, that's not such a good thing. But what happens in terms of these periods of utilization, you can see here, it's not a lot of soil moisture deficit, but you can see it occurs later in the growing season. And then the thing about a xeric regime, once you get the recharge completed, there is an awful lot of surplus water. And that's because you're getting most of the precipitation when it's not being used. And that's why soils in xeric regimes tend to be more leached than you might find in an ustic or an aridic regime. And well, we'll talk a little bit more about that too, but lots of surplus and really dry summers, okay? So those are the characteristics. Now, I don't have a water balance for an aquic soil moisture regime because it's going to be wet all the time. And I don't have one for periutic, but the idea with periutic is you wouldn't have a period of soil moisture deficit just because the precip is going to be exceeding the potential evapotranspiration or the water demand. Okay, any questions about these soil moisture regimes? The one that I just showed you, that's for Phoenix.
Phoenix? And then what was the ustic one?
Oklahoma City.
Okay.
So just one more time. Here's the eutic moisture regime. There's the deficit period, really short. less than 90 days. Here's the Ustic moisture regime, longer deficit period, but you are getting some rainfall in the growing season. And then the aridic moisture regime, lots of soil moisture deficit. And that's kind of the difference, just increasing dryness or period of soil water deficit. And then the xeric regime, like we have, wintertime precip and warm, dry summers. And if you've been around here any length of time, you know that right now the soils are about as wet as they can be. Most are saturated or very close to it. And come back in August sometime and things are going to be bone dry around here, which I think would pose a real challenge for vegetation. But we have a lot of plants around here that are very well adapted to this type of situation. Okay, so remember these names because you're going to see them a lot when we start going through the classification of soils. And in many cases, the soil moisture regime is something that is going to come out at the suborder level. So we may say a soil is a mollisol, and then the next thing that we're going to say about it is that it's one that's got a xeric moisture regime, in which case we'd call it a xerol, or it's got a eutic moisture regime, we'd call it a eudol, and or an ustic moisture regime, we'd call it an ustol. So, as I said, in many cases, these moisture regimes are recognized at very high levels of the classification system. That's how important they are. Okay, well, the last part of it then is the temperature regimes. And let me take a minute and go through these. The moisture regimes kind of deal with seasonality, and the temperature regimes much less so. Generally, we're defining them on the basis of a mean annual soil temperature. So what I'll do is just start here with the cold, and then we'll work up to warmer. And I'm not asking that you memorize these ranges of mean annual temperature that we're going to talk about here that define these things, but just have a general idea of which are the cold ones and which are the warm ones, okay? So we start on the cold end. We have what's known as a pergelic soil temperature regime. And you might recognize the root gel in there, like in gelisol, it means cold. And this is a temperature regime that's defined on the basis of a mean annual soil temperature, or MAST, is going to be less than 0 degrees C. And if you like Fahrenheit, that would be what? 32, right? So these are cold soils, and you think about it from a practical standpoint, these are going to be the soils that are really too cold to do much of anything with. Okay, now we warm up a little bit, we get into what's known as a cryic soil temperature regime. And this is defined by having a mean annual soil temperature, that's hard to read, between 0 and 8 degrees C. Okay, and if you like Fahrenheit, that would be 32 to 47. And the other thing about this, in addition to having that mean annual soil temperature, you might put a note there, plus cold summers. Where do you think you might find a cryic temperature regime around here? Any guesses? Do you think we have them in Washington and Idaho?
Alpine.
Yeah, once you get up high elevations. And one of the things that the NRCS has done to aid in their mapping and soil inventory is they use plant indicators for a lot of these moisture and temperature regimes. I know we'll get to that in a minute. And for example, for a cryic temperature regime, they generally use the presence of subalpine fir and mountain hemlock are the two indicator species that you're in a cryic temperature regime. So low mean annual soil temperature and also cold summers. Now the next one on here, frigid, sounds cold. And it is. It's just like cryic in that it's 0 to 8 degrees C is the mean annual soil temperature, somewhere in that range. The difference is in a frigid temperature regime, you have warmer summers. Okay, the next one here is mesic. M-E-S-I-C. And mesic temperature regimes represent those soils that have a mean annual soil temperature between 8 and 15 degrees C, which corresponds to 47 to 59 degrees Fahrenheit. We have thermic. And a thermic regime, the mean annual soil temperature ranges from 15 to 22 degrees C. And that would be 59 up to 72 degrees Fahrenheit. And then we have the warmest, which is hyperthermic. I'll write it over here. And for the hyperthermic, the mean annual soil temperature would be greater than 22 degrees C or greater than 72 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, these were originally set up because of the agronomic implications. And the idea here is that we said pergelic is just too cold. You know, that's areas of permafrost and really cold soils. The cryic soils are the ones that don't have a long enough growing season to do much of anything besides perhaps grow a hay crop. All right, the frigid temperature regime is really thought to correspond to the areas where you can produce small grains, the wheat, barley, those types of things. Mesic is more of the corn belt, the soybean belt. Thermic, you're getting into things like cotton and they don't grow much of that in the United States anymore, but the warmer, the plants that have a higher temperature requirement. And then something like hyperthermic is where you get into things like sugar cane and the types of plants that really do need warmer temperatures. Now, one other little twist about these temperature regimes. You will sometimes see this prefix ISO added to the front of one of these. For example, you might have an ISO hyperthermic soil temperature regime. And what ISO refers to is it means there's less than a 6 degree C difference throughout the year. In other words, from winter to summer, if you want to think of it like that. So think about here, when in January, our mean annual temperature is probably pretty close to freezing or below. And in the summer, July, August, our mean annual temperature is going to be up in the 70s. So, you know, we have this really big swing. Where would you go to find ISO temperature regimes?
Tropics.
tropics. And this is something that is really important to keep in mind, is that this is what really defines what we call the tropics. This idea that there is a very small swing in mean annual, or a very small swing in temperature, whether you're looking at mean winter or mean summer temperature. There's not much difference, and that's the whole idea. You're going to have essentially a constant temperature throughout the year, or fairly close to it. You'll see a little bit of variation, but it's not like we see in the temperate regions. So the tropic, when people talk about the tropics, we often assume, oh, that means a humid rainforest type of environment. It could, but more specifically, what it means is that you're in one of these areas with an iso temperature regime, like isohyperthermic. There are areas in the tropics that are very, very dry. So, you know, it's the concept of the tropics is really more about temperature than it is moisture. Any idea where you might find an iso temperature regime around here?
Along the coast or something?
Yeah, there are areas in the coast. I don't know about Washington, but certainly down in Oregon and California, where you might have something like an isofrigid temperature regime, where it stays cool most of the year. It really doesn't warm up a lot in the summer, and doesn't get that cold in the winter time. And I do know of an example of at least one isohyperthermic that you could get to within a day's drive from here. Anybody want to guess where that is? Isohyperthermic, within a day's drive. Arizona? How fast do you drive? Isohyperthermic. Yellowstone Park has several soils that are associated with the thermal features, the mud pots and so on, where it's constantly a warm temperature throughout the year. And even though Yellowstone Park gets really cold, the soils maintain this more or less constant temperature. And some of them are quite high.
But it's not because of the temperature of the air, but
That's the geothermal temperature that's driving that. It's just kind of odd. You wouldn't think about Wyoming and Montana being a place where you'd have isohyperthermic temperature regimes, but there are some in Yellowstone Park. And I imagine if you got around any of the hot springs, you're probably going to find something like that as well. So I would suspect Idaho's got quite a few as well. They're just going to be very small areas geographically. Okay, so let's look at here's the map of the temperature regimes in the United States. This is a little bit easier to decipher than that soil moisture regime map. Okay, up here, the northern tier of states, Maine, upper New England, across the Dakotas, Minnesota, and Montana. This is all the these would be the frigid temperature regime. The yellow is thermic. The purple color here would be, frigid, mesic, thermic, and then this purple color, violet color down at the very southern tip would be hyperthermic. And you can see we don't have a whole lot of hyperthermic soils. They're mainly in Texas, Florida, and a little bit down here in Arizona and Southern California. It's more complicated here in the West, and so you're once again seeing the orographic effects. And the darker blue here would be the higher elevations, and those are the cryic soils. You can see the frigid scattered in here, and then the mesic would be all the yellow that you see there. In Moscow, Pullman, our soils here are mesic. We're actually kind of at the lower end of the mesic temperature regime, so we're not too far from being frigid. And if you look on the map up here, you can kind of see that most of the Palouse shows up as yellow, but then you don't get too far to the east of us here, and you're in that light blue or the frigid temperature regime. And again, originally these things were set up because they broadly correspond with cropping zones, like the southern states and these states. But I don't think that's really so much of a concern, especially in the West. But as I said, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, when they're out mapping soils around here, especially in the mountainous areas, they need to have some guidelines for where these different moisture and temperature regimes are, and they use plant communities. And you can see the this is a key that was developed locally, and I don't know how far you can extrapolate it, but it does work around here. And that is, as I said, subalpine fir, mountain hemlock, that puts you in a cryic temperature regime and a eutic soil moisture regime. So that would be the cold, moist end of things. And if you get to the drier end of things, you look down here, this would be ponderosa pine and nine bark, the ocean spray. These would be a mesic soil temperature regime and a xeric soil moisture regime. So the wetter, or the drier and warmer end of it. And then you've got different combinations in here. So, you know, western hemlock, western red cedar, frigid soil temperature regime, eutic soil moisture regime. You get into the grand fir, and this is kind of where it starts to change. Some of the grand, all of the grand fir is frigid, but depending on the understory, it's considered eutic if you have things like wild ginger and queen cup bead lily and those things, or the certain ferns. And if you have ocean spray, nine bark, twin flower, then it would be a xeric soil moisture regime. So these are some of the tools that get used, but it's a very good way to think about these breaks in soil moisture regimes and soil temperature regimes. Because let's say from Moscow, you could go up on Moscow Mountain and you're probably gonna find some areas of subalpine fir. They're not gonna be a lot, but you know, you can certainly get into frigid and eutic, frigid temperature regimes and eutic moisture regimes without going too far. And as you go to the west into Washington, it gets warmer and drier. You get out in the Columbia Basin, and there are probably going to be some aridic soil moisture regime soils out there, and also mesic temperature regimes. We don't get any warmer than that this far north. Okay, questions about this? Like I said, you don't need to worry about memorizing all those temperature breaks, but you should know what the difference between cryic and frigid is, and you know what's warmer, what's cooler, because you're going to see these names crop up again and again, and it's good to have a good mental picture of what does it mean. Okay, well, that's it until after spring break.